And welcome back.
Hope you had a wonderful day. Thanks for choosing to spend some time here tonight with me and my guest. Webster Tarpley is back this evening. He has generated an awful lot of positive email and response from you folks. He is becoming, I think, as well known as almost anyone who is writing on a 9/11 issue today. In fact, he has a new book out called 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism Made in the USA by Webster Griffin Tarpley, published by Progressive Press of California. And we'll tell you how to get that book as we continue. This is another 9/11 book, but before you say, oh no, not another one, this is different. This is unique. And let me just read a little bit from Webster's own explanations as to why he wrote the book and what he's trying to do with it. And I think he has done it more than brilliantly. The reader will understand the book better after a short note on the criteria of selection which have informed it. There already exist encyclopedias and encyclopedic timelines on 9/11 by such writers as Nico Haupt and Paul Thompson, to both of whom I am indebted for much empirical material. My aim has not been to compete with them in exhaustive completeness, but rather to offer a definitive hypothesis about what happened on September 11th. This book has therefore been constructed along the following conceptual lines. And there are three main threads. One, mass gullibility. And I think, you know, we see that all the time. Mass gullibility. It's frightening. About the events of September 11th is based on unmediated sense certainty, reinforced by merciless and repetitious media bombardment. Well, I'll vote for that. And number two, the book stresses those aspects of September 11th which indicate state sponsorship by a rogue network or invisible government operating inside the United States government and military. Other aspects are given less consideration or omitted entirely in this new book. And the new book by Webster Tarpley stresses those aspects of the official version which are physically impossible. Many dubious aspects and contradictions of the official story are not treated if they can be construed as a matter of opinion, rather than being susceptible to rigorous physical proof. Those are just three quick little ideas about how this book was thought out and constructed. Welcome back, Webster. How are you?
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm fine. How are you?
Well, I'm probably like you and most anyone else who cares and is concerned and who has at least a reasonable sense of the amount of noise on the Internet. You were very kind. Of course, Nico and Paul have done wonderful work, as have many others. But we have been, in the last 3 years, I think, literally drowned in material about 9/11. A lot of it is crap. It's disinformation. We know full well that if there is indeed a rogue element or invisible aspect of the government that's behind it or was involved with it, they are certainly more than willing to expend every energy on the Internet to confuse people. And I think you're well aware of that, and most of our listeners are also. It's quite a scene out there anymore, and I'm glad to see you do this book, because there are a few people like yourself that I think we can look to for true leadership in the inquiry that all of us, I think, individually and collectively are trying to make.
Well, that's very kind of you. That's what I've tried to do. I started off with the idea that there are people in the field who are perhaps technically better prepared than I am to explain why the collapse of the towers is a physical impossibility, or why the notion of a plane, commercial airliner hitting the Pentagon is a physical impossibility. I tried to do justice to those because I think the points of physical impossibility are crucial. Something like Lee Harvey Oswald, he could not have gotten off the requisite number of shots using the equipment that he was supposed to have had. And in the case of 9/11, those kinds of things abound. The collapse of the towers is a physical impossibility. The Pentagon story is a physical impossibility. The cell phone calls may well be a physical impossibility. Anyone who says that the accused hijackers flew the planes is, if not in the realm of physical, technical impossibility, they are very, very close to the border of it. So I tried to keep track of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, the other thing that I tried to do is to give it a political context and a historical context that I think is often not there. My background is I tried to explain at the beginning of the book, and I didn't. I know you haven't been able to look at the entire thing, but I tried to talk about NATO spheres of influence terrorism as I studied it in Central Europe in the 1970s and 1980s, primarily the German and Italian cases, the Italian refugees and the Baader-Meinhof group.
Right.
And I think these were cases that have been shown, especially in the Italian case, it's extremely clear. In retrospect, this was masterminded by NATO, the CIA, and some other stay-behind networks, or stay-behind organisms that were set up for this purpose. And it seems to me that if you want to look at 9/11, you cannot try to derive it from the politics of the Middle East or Afghanistan or something like this, because it's much bigger and it's much more encompassing. It actually grows out of a crisis of the U.S. financial system, out of the U.S. Strategic predicament in the 1990s. I try to stress that the 1990s was a time of tremendous financial tempests, periodic brushes with systemic breakdown crisis of the entire financial system, for one
thing. Well said, yeah.
And at the same time, this the presence of an aggressive network inside the U.S. government that you could see in things like the bombing of Serbia, the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, the brush with thermonuclear confrontation with the Russians at a number of points. I try to talk about the Kursk incident, the sinking of the Soviet or the Russians' most modern nuclear submarine. I try to point, for example, to the negotiations between Bush and Putin on 9/11 as a kind of an attempt to avoid what was otherwise present in the situation, which was the danger of a thermonuclear confrontation. And I try to give it this kind of political framework. So that would be one side. The other thing is the conceptual framework. The idea here is, of course, that you know there are just billions of discrete facts that are connected to this. But in order to make sense out of it, it seems to me that you have to apply what we know about terrorism based on precisely these European examples, and I try to suggest a way to look at it, and it's this notion of the patsies, the moles, the command center, the expert professionals, and the corporate media. And it seems to me if you look at it this way with a kind of division of labor, then a lot of it begins to fall into place, because I think people are very, very confused about this stuff.
Very much so. I agree.
The patsies would be the people that we're told are the, according to the official version anyway, the key players, people like Osama bin Laden or Mohammed Atta or any of these 19 characters that were shown.
Six or eight of whom are still very much alive, of course. But
at least five and perhaps more.
Yeah,
and of course, the problem is not only are they alive, or at least people with that name are alive, there's very little known about them. In other words, the assertion that they were on these planes is completely unproven. We don't know anything about any hijackers when you get right down to it. We're asked to believe this on faith.
But we got those, gee, Webster, we got those nice pictures within hours of the knowledge. I just don't understand
it. Highly suspicious. I mean, I think these are Oswalds. In other words, they are people, these are essentially double agents, dupes, doubles.
Right.
They inhabit a kind of a patsy world. I quote in the book the famous novel The Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad from about 1910. Which describes the world of agent provocateur and double agents in the London embassy milieu, with the Russians wanting to blow up the Greenwich Observatory to have an effect on a conference in Milan and get a crackdown on radical groups across Europe. The patsies are essentially the expendable component of this thing. These are generally psychotics, quite frankly.
Well, yeah, and I was going to say that fits the alleged actions of the flight school crew taking these Cessna flight lessons and ending up allegedly involved with this whole thing on September 11th. There are a number of things you mentioned. If we can just pause right there
and
remember where you were, I'm going to go back. you raise always when you visit with us, so many important issues. We have a break coming up. Let's do that. Come right back. I want to start off with the Red Brigade Bader-Meinhof example you used.
Great.
If there was ever a template, folks, not a dry run because people died, but a precursor to where we are now with the feared and vaunted worldwide octopus of the deadly psychopathic Al-Qaeda network. I mean, you look back, and Webster is brilliant at going back and looking at history. This is where many historians are always looking, and Webster did that, and not many 9/11 experts and authors and researchers have looked this direction, so that's why his new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism Made in the USA, is so essential to understanding what happened here. Back in just a minute. Back right with you. I'm Jeff Rensselaer with Webster G. Tarpley. Terrorism as a political device is not new. False flag operations are not new. These are old devices. But they have been updated, revamped, and made far more sophisticated through the use of technology and many other tricks of the trade. The Bader-Meinhof and Red Brigades, some of our listeners younger won't remember that. Many of you will. This is important to go back and look at for a number of reasons. Webster, I would appreciate if you talk a little bit more about that, because these were ops. These were operations. We can go back before that to Operation Northwoods and see how our own American CIA was planning to kill Americans en masse to create panic and justify an invasion of Cuba and anything else they wanted to justify. These are old tricks, but I think these two gangs, alleged gangs, are very pertinent and relevant to the Al-Qaeda myths, which by and large is exactly what it is.
Yes, I think that's one of the keys, and that's one of the things that made me want to write the book. The Bader-Meinhof group, we can't really give a complete history of it, but it ironically came out of a collective, a kind of a support group for patients at a mental institution,
uh-huh,
a psychiatric hospital in Heidelberg, in the 1960s. And, of course, Heidelberg is one of the headquarters of the U.S. Army in Europe, so it wasn't necessary to look too far. And rather than give a complete history, the Bader-Meinhof group starts off, I'm convinced, as a totally controlled entity. In other words, the people who are in it are maybe dupes. They may not be witting. I don't think a lot of them could be witting because they're mm-hmm. Mental impairment probably made it impossible for them
well,
to
the
realize
story,
what they were doing.
Exactly. The stories we get out of Dan Hopsicker, the lifestyles and all that, the drugs and everything else, that doesn't make sense.
If you're going to be a patsy, it helps not to be very bright, because then you're less likely to realize how you're being manipulated. However, within that group of non-witting people, there are these active double agents and provocateurs who know what they're doing, and they report to terrorist controllers, that is, case officers, who basically make sure that the group can carry out an operation if they need to do it. I'll just give one case. Now, this touches the so-called third generation of the Bader-Meinhof group, but for me, there's really no difference. The first, the second, the third are all totally controlled assets of NATO intelligence, which mm-hmm. is what I wrote about this stuff at the time, from the late 70s through the 80s into the early 90s. In the early 90s, East Germany had collapsed, and all of the state property, remember this was a communist country, so there were a lot of chemical plants and steel plants and automobile plants and all kinds of, you know, it's a very industrialized part of the world. All the state property of the former German Democratic Republic, that is communist East Germany, mm-hmm. had passed into the hands of something called the Trusteeship Agency, or Treuhand, as it was called in German. And the question was, what would become of this stuff? And it was worth a lot, even sort of as liquidation value, right? If you're going to junk it. So the bankers in London and New York demanded that all of this stuff be sold off as soon as possible, at the lowest possible price, so that they could cash in. And instead, the guy who was running it, his name was Rohweder, R-O-H-W-E-D-D-E-R, said, no, I think it's important to keep these jobs and to keep the production going.
How dare he?
And let's find a gradual way to modernize these plants, and perhaps some of them can be sold, but there's no reason not to have a fairly large state sector for quite a while. A lot of countries have had it and have done very well with it.
Yep.
And it turned out that one evening he went home, and he had a very bad habit of reading in his study on the second floor with the light on, and allegedly one of the members of the Bader-Meinhof group got up into a tree right next to his little study in his home and shot him, killed him, with a shot through the window. And as soon as he was gone, everybody immediately understood what had happened at this level, and he was replaced by somebody who came out of a New York investment banking background, who immediately began selling off the entire state property of East Germany so that the Anglo-American bankers got what they wanted. Now, of course, all of this is clothed in this fantastic rhetoric of Marxism and revolution and the proletariat and imperialism and the entire Marxist verbiage. But what you had there was a group of assassins working for NATO intelligence. Some of them were witting. Many of them were not. And they were basically run by a group of double agents in the middle. So this was a way to remove certain people. They also killed a banker back in the 1970s. Jürgen Ponto was a banker who wanted to he basically wanted to have development contracts with African countries, and people like Kissinger and Brzezinski didn't want this. So that was what happened to him.
He was a pretty powerful banker, as I remember the story.
Oh, he was the head of, Dresdner Bank. So
one of them, Deutsche Bank or Dresdner. Yeah, I think you're right.
He was bank in the country.
Well, he was a very big player. It's amazing how we always end up at the bankers, sooner or later. We end up at the banker's doorstep almost every story.
But again, he was a somewhat different kind of banker. In other words,
I mean, talking about the London bankers who wanted to sell off the assets. And it always goes back to the banks. Eventually.
The New York and London wanted to be the only people lending to these African countries, so therefore this guy had to go. Now, that's the German example. The other thing just to bear in mind there is Germany was always tempted to some degree by neutralism. There was always a notion that the Cold War had something artificial about it, that Germany was right there in the front line of this thing, and that maybe it would be a good idea to calm things down. And that was generally the attitude of German politicians. A lot of people in the United States, hardliners like Kissinger and some others, always had the idea, no, we don't want to calm things down. We want to keep tensions very, very high. So this
policy,
was another use of the Bader-Meinhof group.
Exactly, and a policy which has continued with great vigor to this very moment. Back in just a couple minutes with Webster Griffin Tarpley. His new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism Made in the USA. Okay, Jeff Rentz back with Webster Tarpley. Webster, were you listening to that last... Did you hear that last commercial?
Yes, I heard it.
The road rage commercial?
Quite interesting.
You know why? It just reminded me of the Bush-Cheney foreign policy.
Well, you know, we have President... the tenant of the White House, to put it more accurately.
The resident, not president.
He can't appear without Cheney, so he's got to sit in Cheney's lap. But Cheney, it turns out, can't appear without Lynn Cheney.
Now, that's interesting.
You've got to imagine a government where the puppet president sits in the lap of the puppet vice president, who is told what to do by Lynn Cheney, who probably presumably takes a poll among the neocons, and then she's some sort of Lady Macbeth figure in this entire thing. And I'm sure there's a lot of rage.
One hears, if one listens, a few uncomplimentary things about the resident's wife as well. So.
Yes, although perhaps her role is, well, she's becoming more and more politicized. I thought what she had to say about stem cell research was a scandal. She has no place in commenting on this.
I agree. All right. Now, back to your preliminary remarks, which were all fascinating, and I wanted to go next just to make mention of a story that we ran the other day, and I'm sure you saw, an enormously large building in Venezuela, 730-foot tall skyscraper,
right,
burned and somehow managed to remain standing. It didn't fall in unison as one into a pile of rubble. It stood up, and they put the fire out. So that was just an interesting little note.
And this, of course, every time there's a fire in a large office building, this becomes an embarrassment to the official version.
It's true.
Because, of course, no modern steel-reinforced fireproof office building has ever collapsed, except for 9/11, when three of them did, and not the Meridian Plaza in Philadelphia in the early 90s, or the large building in Los Angeles that burned for quite a while, quite lustily,
yep,
and so forth. So you have all of those physical impossibilities. Before we leave the tradition of NATO spheres of influence terrorism, maybe we'll talk about the Red Brigades a little bit?
Yes, we will. I just wanted to duck this building and just kind of a little change of pace and work off of that that PSA, which we heard. That road race thing, that says a lot about the American, the modern American, the ugly American, as far as the world is concerned. By the way, two floors of that building in Venezuela actually did collapse, but the building was fine. So, I mean, you know, it does get to be embarrassing. Go ahead. Let's talk about the Red Brigades and finish that.
The Red Brigades, I think, with this we get even closer, because this gets to things that are done on a somewhat larger scale, at least on the Italian model. You mentioned Operation Northwoods before, and, of course, this was this famous document, you know, let's have bombs go off in Washington and New York and Miami, or
it's
let's take a plane and blow it up over Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's signed by General Lyman Lemnitzer, a very, very adventurous, trigger-happy special operations, special forces guy who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Kennedy. And if you look in Dalek's biography of Kennedy, you'll see that Lemnitzer is telling him all the time, use nuclear weapons, and then you'll always win. We could have had the Third World War if Kennedy had listened to this madman, frankly.
You know, it's amazing we didn't, when you think about it. I mean,
it is amazing.
Skated through three decades of almost, and it just never quite happened, fortunately, but wow.
It's not in the past, and I think that's the other question. On 9/11, there was a definite possibility of a brush with the same thing. And let me just since this came up, I try to do an accounting of the 1990s to try to show people that this was not an idyllic time, this was not a calm time. President Yeltsin of Russia told the NATO forces in the spring of 1990, when they were already bombing Serbia, told them, if you invade Serbia, you will get a general European war for sure and probably a world war. When the British and the United States wanted to keep the Russians out of Pristina Airport, this is General Wesley Clark, by the way, doing this, mm-hmm. Michael Moore's favorite candidate for president, came out and told this British general, Sir Michael Jackson, I want you to take over Pristina Airport and kick the Russians out of there. The Russians had sent in a couple of companies from their forces in Bosnia to try to get themselves
owned. That may have been, that was to me probably the most interesting aspect of that whole damned conflict, what the Russians did there, that lightning knife thrust they made to take that airport. It caught everybody sitting on their wallets.
Well, and that's when Sir Michael Jackson had to tell Wesley Clark, I'm not starting World War III for you.
Right.
And then we have the Kursk. I already mentioned it when this submarine was sunk.
Tell me about that. What is your view of that, Webster?
I think that's a provocation by this rogue network. In other words, that's the U.S.-British invisible government, or the NATO invisible government acting. I think if you go back to 1992 and look at the Wolfowitz Doctrine, he talks about making sure that no power ever emerges to challenge the great U.S. superpower. But one of the things he says is we always have to pay special attention to Russia because they're the only ones who can blow us up. And I think what you see is a tremendous commitment to the destruction of the Soviet Union and Russia. One is the early 1990s phase of of shock therapy under Jeffrey Sachs and the IMF and Anders Asland, which cut Russian overall production by two-thirds, so minus 60 to 70%. And I was in Russia at the time, and you see the middle class essentially reduced to begging in the subway. There's no other way to put it. And these would have been scientists and very qualified people, some of the most advanced scientists in the world, are basically trying to sell bottles of milk in the subway. After that, you get a kind of a quiet phase with Clinton and Yeltsin. But then by the time the bombing of Serbia begins, it's clear that there's an attempt to use the bombing of Serbia as a kind of proxy war to humiliate the Russians. So they understand this perfectly. And then beyond that, the Kursk, and we're in August of 2000. So it's the immediate prelude to 9/11 is this Kursk incident. The Russian claim officially from the investigation that they did was a NATO submarine, probably British but possibly U.S., had been playing cat and mouse with the Kursk in the waters of the Barents Sea, where incidents had been reported over the previous years. And essentially the Russian claim was that the Kursk had been sunk either through a collision or through something more active, a torpedo or some other means that was used to sink this submarine. And the headline in Pravda, the Russian paper, was World War III almost began on Saturday, which was the day that this took place. And they had to have George Tenet make a very unusual rush trip over to Moscow to calm this down. And I say this because I go through, in I think one of the chapters that I think is most illuminating of my book is basically what was Bush doing on 9/11, the angel question. Mm-hmm. There's a Russian intelligence group called Namakan, and they essentially say that it's a 9/11 is the work of a rogue network inside the United States, and they view it as a continuity with the Kursk incident. In other words,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. We have a break here.
It's a process of thermonuclear escalation.
Remarkable. So the rogue group here on the way out, real quickly, tied into or linked to somehow the neocons?
Well, certainly, yeah. The neocons.
I mean,
that's it.
That's the visible head of it, anyway.
Right. I think that, and I try to show that too.
Good. All right. We'll be right back with Webster Griffin Tarpley in just a minute. And we're back. Webster Tarpley's new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism, Made in the USA. Webster, how are we going to tell people how to acquire a copy of the book right now?
Well, unfortunately, it's not out yet. We had hoped to get it out before the presidential election. But
no advance orders yet. I thought there were advance orders. Okay.
There are advance orders. You can just send an email to info, that's I-N-F-O as in information, right? Yeah, I-N-F-O at progressivepress.com. And then you get on the mailing list, and you're told how to order the book when it comes out. So info at progressivepress.com.
Good. All right. We'll repeat that again. So this is quite a nifty sneak preview. This is going to be a book, I think, that, again, goes where no others that I know about have gone. And back to the Kursk, if I might. The linkage is extraordinary, as you've explained it. I had always wanted. I ran a number of dozens and dozens of stories about this. Many were wild speculation. Others were very interesting proposals and hypotheses about how this submarine was, in fact, struck by another submarine that had been literally in its shadow, and the Kursk wasn't aware of it. It was crossed. I think it was crossed above by an American or a British sub, and the rear fin of that sub cut through a portion of the Kursk, setting off the initial explosion and followed by a secondary explosion. That was one of many stories. But if that's what happened, there were people thinking along those lines. Now, the Kursk, and then we go back to the Pristina Airport issue, and now let's fast forward to Chechnya. We know full well that the U.S. and probably the British are actively involved in fomenting the Chechen revolt. We also know that within the past month, not one but two, as I read the story, car bombs, undetonated, were found directly adjacent to the path of Putin's motorcade, where it went every day. In other words, he's dead if these things ignite, but they didn't. Now, are they trying to nudge him back to play ball? And where do you see that? That was a very interesting story to me.
Obviously, here now we enter a wilderness of mirrors, and I don't know if there are too many absolutely definitive things we can say about all of this, but I think you can certainly say I tried to follow when this occurred, when the school in Beslan was destroyed and the 300 to 400 people and hundreds of children were killed. The line of some of the most outspoken Russian media was that this had been U.S.-British backed, that had been planned on the Thames in London and on the Potomac in Washington, and that the goal was to render the Caucasus, Trans-Caucasus ethnic situation ungovernable, to drive the Russians out for the sake of oil, for the sake of pipeline routes, but also for the purpose of fomenting the breakup of the Russian Federation, which the Anglo-Americans are not content with having wrecked the Soviet Union. They want to take it one step further and break up the Russian Federation, because this, of course, is, as Wolfowitz says, the only power that can stand up to them if that's necessary.
And that's why they're pushing in Georgia so hard to actually cause an all-out civil war there.
I think people have every right to be disappointed that Putin has made this statement about Bush, that Bush is somehow somebody who he can get along with.
Or, that's a shocker.
A kind of an endorsement, I guess it could be read as.
Yeah.
I would say that since 9/11, Putin has been in a mode of strategic deception, what the old KGB used to call maskirovka, meaning strategic deception, the mask. Putin's goal on 9/11, as far as I can see, was to avoid immediate nuclear war, because I think this was the issue that was posed. You have to remember that on 9/11, the Soviets, the Russians, had scheduled a drill of their strategic bombing forces in the area of the Polar Sea, right, the North Pole region, broadly speaking. And the U.S. had responded to this several days before 9/11 with this Vigilant Warrior, Vigilant Guardian series, which involved sending many of the fighter planes that normally would have been in the lower 48 were sent to Alaska and northern Canada for the purpose of screening against those Soviet or the Russian forces that were mobilized there. Richard Clark in his book tells that he got on the hotline, the red phone, with the Russians and told them that they should stand down their strategic maneuver because 9/11 had taken place. Now, within all of this, there's the question of that phone call to Bush. Angel is next. A lot of people claim this never happened. To me, I believe that it did happen, quite apart from Bush. It's much more important than Bush. And that this is the key piece of evidence of 9/11, because it's the piece of evidence that points unmistakably to a rogue network inside the U.S. government that has access to all of the top secrets. And in the book, I show what Namakan said about this, Angel is next, what the Réseau Voltaire, meaning, in effect, an analysis, let's say, that reflects the insights of French intelligence, a very formidable force, and Debka, which would reflect the views of the Mossad, let's say. And Debka is very, very adamant that the communications coming into the White House from what seems to be the rogue group indicated a broad array of code words and access to state secrets, secret code word, NATO code word, cosmic things of this sort.
If you would, Webster, for our listeners who aren't familiar with that, just give us a very quick synopsis of that phone call.
Well, it is controversial. Again, I believe it happened. The story is that sometime around 10 o'clock in the morning on 9/11, a phone call came into the Secret Service saying, Angel is next. Now, Angel was the code word for that day of Air Force One.
Right.
And there was more to it than just Angel. In other words, there were other things that were said that have somehow not been reported. And the presumption is that Bush went to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, because this was the number two U.S. Nuclear warfighting headquarters. This is revealed by Bamford in his Pretext for War book.
Boy, they don't get much press, do they? That's something that very few people know.
Barksdale is two things. Barksdale is the secondary nuclear warfighting headquarters, and it's also the location of the Night Watch flying command posts. In other words, the Boeing 747s, I believe there are four of them, that are equipped to go into flight for many days, for up to a week if they can be refueled, and provide a headquarters for thermonuclear warfighting. So he goes from Miami to Barksdale, and then he goes to Offutt, which is the number one thermonuclear warfighting headquarters of the United States. And, of course, the notion is that in the course of the day, it's the rogue group. Now, and this is perhaps this is another controversial point. A lot of people would say, well, Bush was involved in this from the very beginning. I don't see it quite that way. I see Bush as being not really told in advance of this stuff, but presented with an ultimatum and told to do what the invisible government group demanded, and that was to unleash the war of civilizations. So that the thing that you would have to say about Bush is not so much that he knew exactly in advance what was coming or that he ran it. I think that's completely out of the question.
Nobody with half a brain buys that one.
His mental ability. He just can't do it. And you can't do it from a government office anyway. You've got to do it from some kind of a privatized command center. But the thing that Bush can be accused of is of capitulating, surrendering, turning the government over in its policies and indeed in its personnel to the people who had run this and were... The way I have a kind of a, what can I say, it's almost a fiction section of the book. It is two speeches. One speech is what a real U.S. president would have said on the evening of 9/11.
Ah, that'd be fun to read, yeah.
And another one is what a real U.S. president would have said approximately the evening of the 25th of September. And what I try to go through there is, using this kind of fictional license, it's impossible to reconstruct this precisely. But the idea is that Bush must have been told something like, either you start the war of civilizations, or we can start it. And the point of that is this: if the conspirators had the Angel Code and related top secret codes, they may have had the nuclear launch codes. And that might have been a way to say to Bush, either you declare war on Afghanistan, Iraq, and so forth, or we'll do it for you. We will launch missiles on Cairo, Tehran, Islamabad, Marrakesh, Morocco, Tunisia. In other words, we'll start the war of civilizations with nuclear missiles, and you'll be dragged into it, whatever you think. And at that point, you'd have to. The president in this point says to the conspirators, but look, if you launch those missiles, the Russians and the Chinese are going to think that that's a first strike aimed at them, and they may decide to launch under attack, and then we'll have World War III. And the conspirators answer, well, you know, make sure it doesn't happen. Capitulate now to us. And I actually think this is plausible, although I clearly distinguish between what I know for a fact and this realm of speculation. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that these conspirators had a very, very broad array of code words and state secrets. And what Debka points out is that this is beyond what any one individual would have known. In other words, it's a network, that's for sure.
Yeah, of course. Now, we also want to keep in mind the small but fascinating footnote that the company which was contracted and which, in fact, fulfilled that contract by installing the highest level of secure communications equipment and systems in the DOD and the White House and the Pentagon, is an Israeli company.
I think that's highly relevant. And I go through that entire question about Comverse, Infosys, and these other Israeli companies, Telrad.
I mean, let's ask ourselves, folks, I mean, honestly, if a company like that, with obviously multiple agendas potential, doesn't put in a system which they can access through any number of back doors, you'd be shocked. Of course they would.
You'd be shocked. But the other thing that is often overlooked is the British component. And what I argue is that if you look at this thing as a whole, you find the British component outweighs any other, including the Israeli. And it's also explicit. Remember, There's something called GCHQ, General Communication Headquarters,
right,
in Cheltenham, England.
Right.
And whatever is known at the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland, is immediately known by GCHQ in Britain. So there's immediate sharing. They don't have to steal it. They get it as a matter of right.
Fascinating. We'll pursue that and much more as we continue at the top of the hour with Webster Griffin Tarpley, talking in advance of the release of his new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism Made in the USA. To pre-order the book, info at progressivepress.com. Be right back.